Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. The Gallagher Premiership has returned and is as tight and unpredictable as ever. The Women's Six Nations has also returned and might be tighter and more unpredictable than usual. So loads for us to get into this week. The men's domestic game, well, there were heavy defeats for the top two. That leaves just 8 points between fourth and eighth. And in the Six Nations, Ireland put up a fighting effort away to France. Scotland won on Welsh soil for the first time in 20 years. And 14-player England comfortably beat Italy. I'm Alfie Reynolds. Welcome back. Thanks for listening to the podcast once again. And once again, I am alongside the rugby correspondent for The Times, Alex Lowe. Hi, Alex.
Hello.
And the deputy rugby correspondent for The Times, Will Kelleher. How are you, boys?
Brought to you by Sudafed this week.
What's wrong?
Just post-Six Nations cold. You can probably hear it in my voice. So I apologise for my sniffling for everyone on this episode. But I think it's one of those where we're battling on. Both of us are going to have a little bit of time off at Easter, but long Six Nations. It's not quite like the players, but journalist welfare. Should we put that in our next game
Maybe.
Agreement?
But then I was at Bath on Sunday. And
yeah, you were actually working and I wasn't.
It was great.
Perfect. Refreshing to come back to club rugby,
Well, it was actually. And it's probably easier for us than some of the players. I think some of the Quins players looked...
Do you think it is easier for us than the players? I'm not so sure.
Everyone, I'm sure, is feeling really sorry for you.
I was really excited by what happened at Bath on Sunday.
It's a cracking weekend.
It was a fascinating return to the Premiership. Some big wins, some surprising wins, and a great contest at the Rec, and perfect spring day for it at the Rec. It's lovely.
It always works well in that the fight for the top four is often so good. But in particular this year, it seems like it's particularly congested. And I think the running is going to be really, really exciting.
I agree. I think it was Johan van Graan said yesterday that 9 teams of the 10 can technically make it. I think we'd be surprised if Gloucester had enough in them to rally from where they are to make the top four. But they're definitely going to have a say in it. And you've got, it's 9 teams on the start line, 6-game sprint to make the top four. It's set up for, and the conditions are good, the pitches are harder, you see teams have evolved a bit how they're playing, there's definitely an onus on attack. Bonus points are going to be really important, which was a factor certainly in the game I went to, Bath taking all 5 and Sale going home with nothing. So there's a premium on tries. If you get a bonus point or two bonus points in defeat, that could be critical. I think it's great. And then Northampton and Leicester, the gun goes off, they trip up on Friday night. Saracens then come storming out of the blocks on Saturday, and Bath, they showed a mettle and an ability to win the game in whichever way they needed to win it against Sale.
Well, we'll get into more on the Premiership a little bit later in the podcast. We're also going to have a bit of a discussion about the cost of a Premiership ticket. Thank you to those of you that have emailed in, a couple of Bath supporters, after the increase for their prices, season tickets and tickets next year, was announced last week. And we'll touch on a few other bits, a few bits of news doing the rounds over the last week or so. And of course, as I mentioned in the intro, the Women's Six Nations returned, England winning away in Italy. And earlier today, I caught up with the latest English centurion. Marley Packer made her 100th appearance in that 48-0 victory over the Italians. Well, Marley, thanks for joining us. Congratulations on the win. Congratulations on the 100th cap as well. We'll maybe come on to that. The performance and result, first of all, stiff Italian opposition. Had to show a lot of character as well after losing a player so early on in the game.
Yeah, like, we always knew Italy were going to be tough. First game of the tournament, going to come out firing. Also for us, it was obviously our first game, had new combinations with the likes of Zoe Harrison, Emily Scarrett and Abby Ward back for the first time since that World Cup final over in New Zealand. But then also the likes of Lucy Packer, Sadia Kabea, they didn't play in WXV. So actually there was a lot of new faces to the new way and the new regime that we're trying to play in. I'm incredibly proud of how the girls went about their performance, and obviously going down to 14, 10 minutes into the game, it is tough course going, but we dealt with it very well. We carried on playing the way we wanted to play. If anything, a little bit of our softer areas let us down, but actually what we said we wanted to do, we did, and it was really positive.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that then. So when you lose a player, particularly so early on, was it a case of just trying to stick to the game plan, or did you have to tweak it out there?
No, we said we didn't need to change anything. We need to stick to what, like, the game plan, not change anything. Obviously, technically, around the line out, around scrum time, we just needed to change personnel and certain areas, whether it's defence or attack. But, you know, we dealt with it really well. And I think, you know, in high pressure situations, it's about being adaptable and, you know, cracking on. And that's exactly what we did. And at the time in that second half, we actually went down to 13. So, you know, it's just full credit to every player that was on the pitch. But also the way we dealt with the situation was, yeah, phenomenal.
It's a good test in a way, isn't it? I mean, you never want to lose a player, but actually when that happens, to be able to adapt and still get a result, I suppose, is quite a good learning curve.
Yeah, you definitely don't never want to lose a player, and losing two players is, and I think, you know, people would say, oh, would you have wanted a better scoreline against Italy? But that game there, like, we will learn so much from it, and there's so many takeaways. There's so many learnings for the younger players, newer players that are coming into the squad. Like, Maddie got her first cap, absolutely, like, smashed it up when she came on. So, yeah, really looking forward to where her Red Roses career takes her.
Yeah, absolutely. It's probably a bit disrespectful for Italy in a way as well, isn't it? To kind of think, oh, you should put more points on them. Because I look at all the games this weekend, and you look at, all right, Ireland lost to France, but they closed the gap there compared to a year ago. Scotland, first win in Wales in 20 years. Like, the gap's always closing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I think the really good thing is that, you know, we got more professionalism. Also, the PWR, like, the girls across the whole of the home nations team all play in the PWR. And you can really see it. Like, Corinne, the winger for Saracens, she got man of the match for that Saracen, for that Scotland game, and lit up, basically. And I just think, like, it's full credit to how professionalism is going, and teams are closing the gap. But for us, for England, that means we need to push on. We need to keep making sure that gap doesn't get too close for us. But then at the same time, it's people going to have to, like, understand that we're not going to be putting 30 points on a team straight away in the first 20 minutes of a game. It's, you know, we've got to work out these teams, like, break them down, play intelligent rugby, and then the score line will look after itself. But is actually making sure that we put performance in. It's not always all about the score line.
Yeah, and you mentioned about developing as well. Like, how are you as a team looking to develop this Six Nations this year? Obviously, John coming in, what's kind of the focus for you guys in terms of what you're looking to improve?
I think for us to improve, we want to bed younger players in, making sure that we've got a really competitive environment, but actually not just on the pitch, off the pitch, is making sure that we have an unbreakable bond, and the way we go about our business is for us to, like, be enjoying the environment, because if we're enjoying the environment and where we're at, we're going to be putting the best rugby on the pitch. And then just making sure that we keep evolving our game and keep posing questions. I think that's the thing massively for me since he's come in, is he's just posed questions that I've never had as a rugby player before, and actually then putting that into practice into the match.
What sort of questions, without giving away all the secrets, that anything in particular that's been really interesting for you, just completely changed the way you're looking at your game or anything?
I think sometimes I was very, this is how we're doing it, let's go do it. But now it's more of a case of like, why we're doing it, tweak it here, or like if we got momentum on our side, could we change it so we don't have to hypothetically kick long to kick out? Why don't we kick high to go get the ball back? But change, it all depends on like the momentum of the game, but also just me as a captain, how I lead the squad.
And speaking of yourself, Marley, as I say, congratulations on the 100. Have you been able to appreciate it at all, or is it because it's the start of a Six Nations and you're focusing on the next game and all that sort of stuff? Have you been able to enjoy getting that 100th cap?
Yeah, we had a really special shirt presentation that was lush. And then also my family all came out to watch the game, which was pretty special and epic to have them all here. Yeah, so it's been amazing. My phone has literally gone wild and I feel bad because I've not replied to anyone. It's just been focused on the game, get through yesterday, because it wasn't just about me yesterday. Obviously, it was Maddie's first cap, and you want to make that as special as possible as well. And, you know, also the girls coming back, and hopefully everyone has enjoyed it as much as I did. And then, look, now our focus is Wales. I think there'll be some reflection time around Fallow Week and then after the Six Nations. But for me, it's next game, Wales, and then we go on.
Yeah, is there special pride of place for the... I see you get a special cap, don't you, for your 100th?
Yes, yeah, you do. I'm not too sure at the moment. I'll probably leave it out on the shelf for a little while. we'll see.
Yeah. Just finally, Molly, that you mentioned there, I mean, Wales at Ashton Gate, that could be awesome. I mean, Wales-England is always awesome. It's always a big game. And in particular, the proximity to Wales at Ashton Gate, hopefully be a great crowd there as well. What an opportunity for the team to kick on following the win on the opening weekend.
Yeah, definitely. And I think like it being in Bristol, not far from Wales, so we should get a big fan base from Wales as well. And look, we want to keep growing the game. And, you know, the more fans we can get in stadiums, the more people can see it, the better for us. And Bristol's a special place for me anyway. I played a lot of rugby in Bristol, in Bath, so West Country, it's close to home. I think it'd just be an amazing occasion. Ashton Gate, the pitch is really nice. So, yeah, I'm just really looking forward to next week.
Well, awesome. Marley, appreciate you joining us. I know you are all travelling back from Italy this morning, so appreciate your time. Good luck for the rest of the Six Nations as well, and congratulations again on reaching 100 caps. Brilliant milestone.
Thank you very much.
Well, great to chat to Marley Packer off the back of her 100th cap, another win for England in the Six Nations. Will it be another year where it's a bit of an English procession? We'll wait and see. As I spoke to Marley about briefly in that interview, though, was encouraging signs in the Ireland performance. Great win for Scotland as well, so we will keep an eye on that. Getting back to the Gallagher Premiership, Will and Alex, we were speaking about it earlier, and what a great weekend it was. Should we start on the Friday night with the opening couple of games? I was at Ashton Gate, so Bristol 52, Northampton 21. Bristol, I thought, were an interesting one in that when we spoke about the break for the Six Nations and how teams would use it, listening to Pat Lamb's comments after was quite intriguing, because he basically said that was exactly what we have been training for. And you got the impression that that break was perfect for them to really focus on certain areas of their game. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to go forward now and be a completely different team to the side that have been quite hit and miss throughout the rest of the campaign. But it seemed to me that Bristol at their best under Pat Lamb was actually, as much of the great rugby they played, was a team who had a really solid set piece, scrum and line out, and a really effective driving maul as well. And it looked like they were getting back to a few of those elements. And that was a big basis, I think, for why they were able to run up
the
scoreboard.
This is sort of the wider intriguing point. Alex and I did a big piece last week to kind of tee up the run-in and say, here, we're back and everyone's had this break that no one's had before. And what does it all mean? There was always going to be a team up the top who sink and a team up the bottom who rise because they got the break right or wrong. And kind of no one knows how to do it because it hasn't happened before. Bristol had a big game against the Crusaders, didn't they? And
yeah, played Bedford as well,
I think. And they were one of the teams that organised one of these sort of marquee friendly fixtures to basically keep the money coming in, sell some tickets. Other teams didn't. Northampton were on the biggest wave after when the break came. I think it was 10 wins in a row. And I spent some time with them last week and they were sort of going, look, they are going to look at the table and know that we're top and had that 7-point buffer before the weekend started. But the aim is to try and not get too down if you start losing or too up if you keep winning. And that's the challenge now, isn't it? Because, again, I think Phil Dowson was saying this. He was like, there's probably going to be a point in the next few weeks where we might lose three in a row and be fifth in the table. We can't be worried about that. We've got to keep doing what we're doing. But it does look alarming, doesn't it, when you get hit for 50 and you're meant to be the best team in the country. But that's why this whole restart is really fascinating. And you've almost got a season of two halves, haven't you? You've got the marathon of 20-odd games in a row and then the sprint at the end. And that'll suit different clubs, won't it? Depending on who were in the international teams and all that. But maybe this is bad of me, but when we were restarting, I'm not sure I thought about Bristol being a top four side, but then they put 50 on Northampton. You go, well, it could be anyone, couldn't it? Definitely could be them.
What did you think? You think that you didn't think that Bristol would be top four?
No, I didn't think they would, just because of they didn't seem to have an obvious style, or it felt like their team had broken up a bit from the Galactico era, didn't it? And they've still got more players who are leaving in the summer. And oddly, it's ever since Pat Lam signed that massive contract until 2028, was it, or 2027? It felt like, literally on that day, I was at the game, they lost to Saracens on the opening match of the season when Saracens had got promoted back. And they've kind of been on this slightly steady decline since, haven't they? But a result like that, and Ashton Gate bouncing, everything else, it's a great city for rugby and the fan base that love it.
Does a six-game sprint suit Bristol more than some? Because just the way that they sort of seem to be starting to play, where they played Bath before the break.
Yeah, it's like 90 points in two games, isn't it, either side of the break?
It's a sort of throwback to the lockdown days when they had Ben Earl and Max Malin's first time round and Samuel Rendrandra. And while they had a structure, their mission was to go out and attack space and to be front foot. And I wonder if, you know, if you're slightly on the fringes of this race for the top four and you can just throw everything at it and have a dart and see how far you get, whether if Bristol can, if they can rekindle that sort of attitude. Sometimes these things can last for six games. It's hard to play that way through the depth of winter and for that kind of boldness to carry you all the way through a long season. But six games, chuck everything at it, play the way that they've been playing, certainly on Friday night, and who knows? It might actually suit them quite nicely.
On that point, Alex, it is interesting, isn't it? Because let's say Bristol go on a three-game stint and then are suddenly second in the league, that whole thing of looking at the table comes into it again, because you go, okay, do you have the conviction to keep going? Or do you start going, oh, hang on, guys, we're in a good position now, just let's calm down, hold off? Whereas maybe there's evidence from what Quinns did in that 2021 season, and that was slightly different because they changed coach and just thought, well, let's have a go, and that took them all the way to the title, ridiculously, didn't it? So you wonder if there'll be someone who has this, I don't know, shot from sixth or seventh right to the top and goes all the way.
Alex Anderson was trying to do the maths, and he reckons that four wins out of the six would be enough because everyone will be taking points
for them
off everyone for them. Yeah. So for him, it's like win the home games, try and grab one away win, and that for them, he reckons, would give them a decent.
But then already that they've lost one.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they've got to win five of the last six. I mean, basically,
he was typical Al. He was trying to put a like a not panic, be measured, and put a positive spin on it. I.e., say it's in our hands still. But everyone will feel that, and that's what's so, like, this table's going to move every week, and it'll come to the last round, I'm sure, on the results on the final day.
I think we mentioned this. I can't remember when, but it must have been in pre-Six Nations January, maybe it was December or something. That possibly all four positions in the playoffs could be solved on the last day, which would be incredible. I don't think
how
that's
good
ever
would that
been.
Be?
Well, often those Saturdays where they try and ape the Premier League and they play all at the same time, there's actually only really one match that's finalising something, or you have to build up like the race for the final Champions Cup spot for someone to get battered next season in the pool stage, which is not that exciting. Whereas this time, you think, now that Northampton have already been reeled in, you could have all four decide on the final day, which would be ludicrous, wouldn't it?
And it's so funny, isn't it, looking at just the final word on Bristol is, I think generally I've looked at them, and most people have looked at them this season and felt like they're not having a great year, really. They're stop-start. But I think it's 5 wins in their last 6 in the Premiership, which dates all the way back to the start of December, because we had multiple rounds of Europe and it's so broken up. But I don't know, maybe they are making a run for it. Another team who is had a good couple of games, really, is Gloucester. They beat Leicester also on the Friday night. Stephen Varney, try right at the end.
Great pace.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he was going past a fairly tired Ollie Chesson, which goes back to our point of players coming back, needing rest, whatever. But that little extra acceleration. I mean, Varney played the whole Six Nations himself, didn't he? With Pajarello, the nine in Italy. But that was a really unexpected and awesome finish to that game, wasn't it?
Well, speaking of teams changing their fortunes around, I remember being at Gloucester Sale, which was the Sunday game, the final game before it stopped, before the Six Nations, and Gloucester finally got a win before that. It felt like they couldn't buy a win. They'd been on this terrible run. They won there, which I'd imagine was a massive relief, changed the whole feel of the club heading into the break. They then win the Prem Cup, and then they come back out the other side and get their first victory at Welford Road in 17 years.
So we have an email on this topic, Alfie.
So this is the ruck at thetimes.co.uk.
So we need a sound effect whenever we have
you
an email.
You got mail, yeah. One of those kind of, yeah. Yeah, well, we got an email, and it's from our colleague and friend, Matt Cotton, who's at this current point in time, probably downstairs.
Cause I was going to say, this London is an email Bridge. From someone that works in the building.
Look, we take every we'll email we get.
As long as it's not from IT, we don't
yeah,
mind.
Actually, there was another IT one. We don't need to go on that one. But he said, okay, two-part question is both kind of on Gloucester. How big an impact do we think winning the Prem Cup will have on Gloucester? They went 100 days without a Premiership victory until just before the Six Nations break, and now have won 6 in a row in all competitions. Granted, Prem Cup is not everyone's priority, but beating Chiefs and Tigers in front of your own fans to win some silverware must, at the very least, lift the King's home gloom. Winning becomes a habit and all that. And then also, he's sort of on this Kingmakers point, so they might not end up winning anything other than the Prem Cup, Gloucester, but they could influence who does, because he's basically saying, how big an influence do you think they'll have on the final standings? Because they've got Bristol at home, Sarries away, Chiefs home, Saints away, Newcastle home. I guess the answer to the second bit is, yeah, they'll have a huge influence, that they can ruin someone else's season.
But so will everyone as well.
Yeah, I suppose. I guess it's one of those where they're sitting in maybe a falser position, lower down the table, and they're kind of in this mode where they're spoiling other teams' seasons and players are coming back fit and all that. But yeah, you've got to... That's maybe where the Prem Cup... It had a funny old life, hasn't it, in different forms, whether it was the Anglo-Welsh or the LV or now the Prem Cup, and people use it for different reasons, whether it's a development thing or whether it's keeping a team ticking. I think actually next season it would be great, and this is what they're intending to do, is to play more of the Prem Cup in the gap, which will keep money coming into the turnstiles at the clubs that are still in it. They played it early in the season this year because of the World Cup to get that going before the Prem started. But it's a good momentum driver if you go and win something, and they hadn't won anything for 9 years, Gloucester, so...
Is it, though?
Do you not think so? Like, well, winning in front of the shed and lifting a trophy?
I mean, look, that's obviously not a bad thing, but it's a funny old competition, the Prem Cup, isn't it? Teams often use it virtually as a
reserve
team.
So I think if Sarries had won it, you go, OK, well, it's the Prem Cup, well done. But I think for other teams, like I remember years back, Quinn's winning one at Six Ways and... against might have been Sale or Wasps or someone like that. And it's one of those things that if you don't win trophies very often, it's a nice thing to have in the cabinet. And like, I remember Exeter winning one in their earlier days and did a bus tour around the city because of it, because it was the first ever major in inverted commas trophy.
I think it's important. It's context, isn't it? I think this one's important for Gloucester. I think you're right. The early rounds of it are often... I mean, we've had years where teams having to recruit players from local universities and just because to try and get a team together and they just had to fulfill an obligation. I think that was different this year, and the idea is it should be different going forward. But by the time you get to the semis and the final, particularly for Gloucester, particularly given that it came in the break when they weren't otherwise playing any competitive rugby, it gave, you know, they fielded full, you know, strong teams, pretty much as strong as they could. It gave them all a focus and something to achieve out of what had been a kind of testing, challenging and disappointing campaign for them. I think the mood around the place and the idea of changing the momentum of the club is valuable. And I totally take your point. It's, you know, if it's a very much a sort of second tier trophy for most clubs and at most times, but it feels to me like it fell at a really important opportunity for Gloucester, and they took it. They've carried that into at least the first round of the Prem restart.
So thanks to Matt for the email, and he makes a very good point of, do we know anywhere that people can read a Premiership guide, maybe on a Wednesday? Matt writes one, so
it's very good. Actually, it is very good. I'd recommend
stats,
it.
Lots of stats, lots of 1,078 days since and all that. Yeah. So yeah, so pick up that.
A few good gags. A bit too much drooling over Exeter.
You're okay.
Room for improvement there, Matt.
No, he's a big Chiefs fan. He's allowed.
But yeah, thanks for the email. So good win for Gloucester. Disappointing defeat for Leicester. It leaves them seventh, but in the way that the table's so bunched up, a couple of wins here and there and the complexion can change. Should we get on to the Saturday games, the one that has drawn the most headlines, both for the brilliance of Saracens and some other stuff, which we'll come on to. It was Saracens' absolutely thumping victory, 52-7 over Harlequins. Just very, very quickly on Quins, it looked like a team that were just, like, mentally, to me, miles away from where
it
they needed
like
to be.
It was like they were... It's a bit like that, going back to our football thing, when you're that team who are sitting 10th and have got nothing to play for and you're on the beach, in inverted commas. It looked like they were already there and you're thinking they're second in the table.
The second, yeah.
Absolutely absurd. And like Joe Marler's done his often does this, doesn't he? When after a bad defeat, he goes and tweets saying we were rubbish and all that. But they were really, really embarrassingly bad. It was quite alarming, I thought.
And that they massively missed having a character like Owen Farrell in yeah. the team.
Standard because, right, driver.
I went to see him last Wednesday and he had to talk about his decision to stand down from the Six Nations and his decision to join Racing because it was the first time he'd addressed those in public. But he could not wait to get on to talk about playing Harlequins at the Tottenham Stadium. He'd had 8 weeks without a game of rugby, and Owen Farrell can't really cope with 8 weeks without a game of rugby.
I could sort of see him drumming his fingers on the table being
honestly,
like, come on.
This was the Wednesday. You know what the intensity is going to be like. You could just tell from the way he spoke. And Mark McCall, kind of whispering, measured, calm. Farrell was like, you just knew. He often says how excited he is. And I think it's genuine. We hear it a lot. But this time you just knew. And then you saw in the game the standards he was driving, the admonishment he gave to Hugh Tizard for trying the offload, and, you know, swear, like, basically that's a stupid decision, it's not good enough.
When they're 40 points
when
up.
They're like, yeah, yeah. And, you know, they're cruising. That drive, which comes from Farrell, is replicated in lesser form, but it's a habit that flows into the team around him. That's why in that environment he's so important. I don't think Quins have anyone like that. They're a very different environment. They're much more collegiate. Let's go and play a bit of football. Let's kind of dial down training this week. And then we'll turn up on... So I'm not saying they're any less professional, but they have a different approach to their rugby.
Well, when it clicks in a different way.
Exactly, yeah. Right. And it just was very obvious that they really needed a character like Owen Farrell last week.
And we always said that Saracens was a sort of club that you could absolutely see them using that 8 weeks and then just rolling through it to defend their title.
I sort of... Like, we love rivalries, don't we? And any spice is good, really, unless it goes over the top. But it's not maybe as this level, but it's as in the one I'm going to use an example of is not probably as strong as the Quinn-Saris thing. But it's a bit like Ireland's disdain of Scotland that is clear, isn't it, in the Six Nations, where they go, Scotland, are you joking? They think they're going to come here and beat us. Like, seriously. I quite like that chest out, chin out stuff from Saris, where they clearly think ill of Quins because of all the stuff that's happened over the years and all the brickbats and all the slagging of the salary cap and everything else. And the fact that they're so different and they play in such a different way and they have a bit of fun on social media about being London's club and all that sort of stuff. And they especially when they play those games, whether they've been at Wembley or Tottenham, they don't just beat them, they absolutely take the mickey out of them.
But just on that, and I know there is genuine animosity between the clubs, it's a rivalry that to me it feels like it could do with a really good Quins win. It's so one-sided.
It's a bit like the old years of before Scotland became really good in the Calcutta Cup, wasn't it, when England would just beat them all the time. And it would just be like...
Can we tell the story? There's a colleague of ours at a different newspaper wrote in his preview for the Scotland-England game a few years ago. this is not a rivalry anymore. We can't call this a rivalry. Scotland aren't even competitive. And then they won.
It was a 2018 game.
They won at Murrayfield and Finn's have pass barely and lost since.
But you're right. You're right.
Which he's reminded about on an annual
regularly,
basis.
Yeah. But yeah, you're right. A rivalry is only a proper rivalry when both teams win it every now and then. Like you'd say that Saints-Tigers is a bit more like that.
Yeah, but I mean, it's got so many great elements, the Quinn-Sarries as the rivalry, in terms of everything that's happened. As you've just mentioned, the cultural differences between the clubs, that they're both in London, but just from a sporting competitiveness point of
but
view.
But the thing that kept the spice going was the salary cap. Like, that was what, there was genuine, like, they genuinely felt cheated by Saracens. Yeah. And were not afraid to say it. They were not afraid to come out and basically say that we've been cheated by them and it's a disgrace. And that added spice to it. Now, underneath all of it, like, Danny Kerr and Jamie George are best pals. But in terms of a sporting rivalry, that spice, that salary cap, like, element added a whole lot of spice to it. But the further away we move from that, without Quinn, sticking one on their nose, the less it feels like it matters.
Shall we get on to the TMO stuff?
Yeah, go on.
It's probably arguably the biggest headline to come out of the weekend.
Now that you've mentioned it, are we going to be able to talk about it though? Like, you flagged it, so therefore we should probably just leave it, shall we?
Honestly, there was a moment at Bath when their first try, Finn Russell's
forward pass.
It was forward and right behind me, I can hear Austin Healey saying, well, that was obviously forward, this should be no try. And then the TMO doesn't even look at it.
I texted you being like, that was very forward.
It's like, hang on, this can't be happening again, surely.
Many people would already be aware, if you're listening to a rugby podcast, but towards the end of the Sarries-Quins game, was it Stefan
Lavise,
who essentially slid in on Owen Farrell, kind of two
It was like
knees.
A sort of half-assed cheap shot.
Yeah.
And it was late off the ball.
And Austin Healey immediately on the commentary was saying, that needs to be looked at. And then we could hear discussions with the TMO, essentially, I'm kind of glossing over it and paraphrasing, but essentially saying, I don't want to look at that because it will look like I'm looking at it because Austin Healey has mentioned it on the commentary.
Because there's been issues with this in the past, and I can't remember the exact incident, but people have thought around the game that particularly Austin Healey has had too much of an influence over what the TMO is looking at, because he's very good at spotting those.
But why is that a bad thing?
I know.
Like, he's brilliant. He's the best TMO that there is.
Yeah, honestly, he is. But I think the wider issue is, why necessarily have the TMO's truck got the commentary on? Should they have it off?
So, typically with rugby, there's a bit of a storm, and
it's sort of no one's fault.
Which has happened. Like, his mic was obviously faded up when it shouldn't have been.
The TMOs.
I think so. Otherwise, why would you have... I don't think we were supposed to have heard that.
Yeah.
I don't know why he would say, I can't look at it because it'll look like I'm following Austin. That's the crux. That's the actual problem. Why is the TMO thinking that just because it's been flagged on TV, he shouldn't be looking at it? If he'd missed it, fine. But if it's been flagged and been alerted to it, and it's important enough... I mean, we've had a lot of issues recently with TMOs getting involved in things I don't think they should get involved in. TMOs don't need to get involved as much as they do. But if they feel they need to get involved, whether they've seen it or whether Austin Healey's seen it, then they should be getting involved, because you can't be condoning foul play. If that's worthy of a yellow card, then the guy's getting a red card. That has an impact, not on this game particularly, but going forward. So that's the crux of the matter. But Will's point there about whether the ref should be able to hear it or not. I mean, the fudging that's been going on from Premiership Rugby and the RFU over this point in the last couple of days is ridiculous.
Yeah, do we know, is it because they're sitting in the TV director's truck, because that's how they get the different angles they want, so therefore they're able to hear the commentary in the background?
So the way it's been explained is that they don't directly get the commentary, but because of their position near the director, they are likely to sometimes hear some commentary. I mean, what kind of a position is that? They either have it or they don't have it, like, directly. But you can't say, because what confused me was they've always told us, I'm just certain they've always told us, that they don't get the commentary feed. They just have the pictures. So you can't say, yeah, no, they don't get the commentary feed, but of course, you know, they're sitting next to someone who does, so they might overhear it. I mean, what a kind of a nonsense situation is that? Just let them have it and do it properly, or stick them in another room.
Well, that's kind of at the World Cup just gone, and in football, the VAR guys are in Stockley Park, aren't they? Yeah. They're not at the ground, which maybe raises different issues, but they did that similar thing with the TMOs at the Rugby World Cup, where they were sitting in the international broadcast centre basically in Paris and not at all the individual games, I think, or certainly that was the intention to start with. So often these things come up and things get changed, but they've got to just watch it with clean feed, basically, don't they? With no commentary.
So and there's been another suggestion that the commentary gets cut when a review's been called for.
I can imagine some director going like...
Yeah, well, how does that happen? Because the director still needs... He's still directing the broadcast output. Anyway, you either have it and just accept that it's another tool to help the TMO, or you cut it completely and put it in another room. Like, but the wider issue is why is the TMO concerned that he can't review a decision that he feels might be foul play just because it's been flagged up on the television? So it's going to be reviewed by the RFU's match officials team. I'm led to believe they don't think there have been previous incidents of this, but if it's happened once, there's every chance it's happened before. The fact this has exposed accidentally officials not wanting to take action because of what's already been broadcast, that should be a concern, I think, to the officials.
For sure. You do often watch games, don't you? And you think that they have heard them almost.
You think so,
It seems that way when all of a sudden they're reviewing something. But we'll see what comes of that. Moving on to the Sunday game, final game of the weekend. We mentioned it earlier, Bath against Sale. Great game, this. The final scoreline, probably not a true reflection of just how good a game it was. Alex, as we said earlier, you were there. Sale fascinate me because, you know how earlier I said, Briss are a team we all look at and feel like they haven't had a great season, but they're there or thereabouts. Sale are a team that I look at and feel like they're a good team, but they've just had so many results that haven't gone their way and they haven't picked up enough bonus points.
Yeah, that is what will disappoint them the most from the game on Sunday. An hour in, it was 24 all, three tries apiece. Bath had Ollie Lawrence in the sin bin. Sale were in Bath territory and the game is there for them. And they couldn't execute it, really, because Bath lent heavily on their pack. And against a Sale team who you would assume that Bath will have the better attack, Sale will beat them physically. So what's fascinating for me was that they traded blows to the point on the hour mark and the game was there, and you thought this was when Sale, they've just scored with Ollie Lawrence off, they've got the momentum, 24 all, this is their chance, next 10 minutes. And actually Bath turned the tables on them and in 10 minutes won the game with a combination of power, set-piece dominance and some real intelligence and brilliance from Finn Russell, including a left-foot drop goal, which is his first in the Premiership, possibly his first ever, I think.
First in his career is what people have been saying, wasn't it?
I feel like he got one for Glasgow years ago.
So I think it's first in the Premiership. Well, definitely first in the Prem. And it was he dropped it onto his left foot and it sort of wobbled over like a sort of drunken ball. And it just, like slow motion as it dipped over, he felt it was never going to get there, and it just did. But it meant that he went from 24 all, they went penalty, drop goal, try, and suddenly the game has changed. And suddenly Sale are looking at this going, can we get two bonus points out of this? We need to try, get within seven, and Bath score again. Ollie Lawrence touches down and they're out of sight. And it was just a really impressive last 20 minutes from Bath. It was a fascinating game. It was a really enjoyable game, I thought. Probably, I think, I saw, as I walked out, Dorian West was shaking hands with Andy Robinson, Robinson was his coach at the 03 World Cup. Robinson's now back on board with Bath. Dorian West is the Sale forwards coach, and he looked furious. He looked furious because you'd think you'd back Sale to win the physical battle, win the set pieces, and they lost it because scrum penalty, maul try.
And do we think with Sale it's a case of they've lost a bit of depth, possibly? Look at Aka van der Merwe, they lost a Dupria. You start to try and find reasons of why the team that were in the Premiership final last year just don't quite seem to have that hardened edge of fading away in games a little bit.
Yeah, Asher Opoku-Fojor came on and, you know, he is a great prospect for England, for English rugby, front row. He's been playing loosehead prop for the England under-20s for the last 2 months, and he comes back and Sale want him back at tight head. He just didn't dominate in the way that we have seen him do it in the Prem. He didn't make the impact that they would have needed from him off the bench.
Shoot your shot is my précis of this, because we see so many teams who get to Premiership finals, don't win them and fall away. Exeter were the exception, where they kept coming. They were happy, as Rob Baxter said at the time, we were happy to be there in 2015 when they lost to Saris and then made the next whatever it was, four or five in a row, and ended up winning a couple. But you've seen it with Bath, you've seen it with Quins at times, you've seen it with Northampton, you've seen it now with possibly with Sale. Wasps make the final and lose it, maybe unexpectedly make the final. Oh, brilliant, we're at Twickenham. Wow, look at this, haven't been here for a long time. Oh, psychological, lose. The next season's hard. And like, the table's so stacked, they could end up fourth or whatever and get back there. But shoot your shot. You've got to shoot your shot. If you've got, like Northampton this season, you win the title, you might not get another chance. This is what happened. And the way English rugby's structured is if you get a young group of decent English players together, win something in 2 years, otherwise they'll leave because of the way that salary cap works and keeping them is difficult. Sale are going to having to get rid of Manu Tuilagi because they've now got to keep their Roebuck, Reed, War, Quirk, all those guys, Carpenter, because they've come off academy contracts and now going on. Leicester have had it. They shot their shot. They won the title and now they're seventh or something, aren't they? So shoot your shot.
Well, a lot of those guys from Sale played really well yesterday, on Sunday. I thought Aaron Reed on the wing, Joe Carpenter.
Great take. One of the awesome takes.
Unbelievable take, yeah, over Will Muir. But also, you know, the way he links offensively with Tom Roebuck, the way that that Manu and George Ford combined, you know, that they created a lot. You know, Roebuck picked off a pass for one of the tries, but, you know, they've got the tools there. They've got the tools. They maybe lack a little bit of the kind of gnarled experience up front, like you say, Alfie, but, you know, they've got the attacking tools. They've got the tools to threaten. It's just, yeah, you're right. This isn't quite what they had.
Can I do a 30-second point? So coming up in 2 weeks, we've got the European Last 16 and Exeter playing Bath, of the six English teams, I think, in the Last 16. The fascinating thing will be who reacts, because half of them probably, maybe more, will lose, won't they? Like Leicester will probably lose. One of Exeter and Bath are going to lose. Quins or Sarries, let's see. Northampton, Munster, let's see. Lots of them are going to get knocked out of that. So do they react well? And they think, okay, look, the Europe thing didn't happen, so we've now all on the Prem. Or is it more beneficial to do two things at once, I suppose? Like Exeter, we haven't mentioned them properly yet, but they had a good win. They're kind of dark horses. But with a young team, if they again get through to a European quarterfinal, does the other thing drop off?
Farrell was talking about exactly that last week, actually. He referred to the La Rochelle quarterfinal from last year, where Levani Bottia just kind of destroyed them at the breakdown for half an hour, and La Rochelle were out of touch. And he said, as disappointing as it was to lose that game and to be humbled in La Rochelle, what it was the making of them in a lot of ways. It was from that defeat that they went and won the Premiership. And he traced a direct line between losing in La Rochelle to Saracens winning the Premiership, and felt a little bit like the Six Nations at, you know, England, the way, the manner in which they lost in Scotland, as difficult it was and as disappointing as it was, as poor as it was almost the making of the Ireland win 2 weeks later, because it brought so much into focus that was going wrong that needed to be fixed. Now, this is a slightly longer term thing, but so it is possible to lose in Europe and actually use it constructively. But I imagine it requires quite a lot of experience and leadership to do that. And I guess, yeah, the manner in which you go down can be impactful too, but that's another area that's going to be an unknown as part of this sprint for the line, is, you know, how do they deal with the various hurdles of success or failure along the way.
Yeah, well, the run-in is shaping up brilliantly. We will have a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk ticket prices, in particular for at Bath, but in the Premiership as a whole, and we'll finish the pod, as we always do, by naming our god or goddess of the week.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey.
If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So, ticket prices. We had a few emails this week. Thank you to all of you that got in touch at theruck@thetimes.co.uk. Richard Morrissey was one of those, which was titled The Finn Russell Premium. But he essentially said, my question for you guys is as follows. How much is too much to pay for a Premiership rugby game ticket? And does pricing people out risk the long-term growth of the game in England? I ask this as a Bath season ticket holder just hit with a 24% increase in season ticket renewal price. And Ed Buckland also sent us a really good email. I can't get through all of it, but essentially he said, I know this might not be your usual topic, but this year's season ticket renewal release was the tipping point for him in terms of his frustration towards Bath. Clubs like Bath should be at the forefront of growing the game and making it more accessible. Unfortunately, it feels like things are heading in the opposite direction, reinforcing the elitist label sometimes associated with rugby. I might be missing something here. Perhaps there's another perspective I haven't considered. But he sent a really good long email, though, which he's also sent on to the club and Tarquin McDonald, outlining his frustrations at the increase in price. It is an important talking point, the cost of a Premiership ticket. How much is too much? Will, what have you made of it?
So this is not just exclusively a Bath thing or exclusively a rugby thing. I was reading the Times on Saturday morning and there was a similar sort of piece about theatre tickets and how much is too much to pay for a ticket to a West End show. So we all kind of understand that everything's got more expensive. Like, I'm looking at my own bills and my energy price and all that has gone up, council tax has gone up, everything. But I think it's particularly frustrating for fans to see that their season ticket is increased massively because there are fewer clubs, there are fewer games, and it's, are they getting the value? And if you look at individual tickets, some are over 100 quid this season, which seems a hell of a lot. That would be more than some test grounds to watch the league. So there's loads to it, so we'll try and kind of cover off lots of different bits of it. But I think, yeah, there's a general feeling at clubs that some of them are growing their individual revenue by quite a bit. So Quinn's were helpful and shared some figures with us last week. And for example, that if they get home quarter final in the European Cup, they might make revenue of about £29 million, which is about £5 million more than they did two seasons ago. And they've cut their losses down from about £3 million to about £500,000. But the central pot hasn't grown that much at all, even though they've lost three clubs. The expectation was that with 10 clubs, the pie gets divided by a smaller number, therefore everyone gets more money, which hasn't really happened. The uptick of central pot has only been about £300,000. Then all the utilities go up, which has affected everyone. Twickenham, they've said their utility bill went up £5 million, from around £2 million to £7 million. That's just turning the lights on and putting on the fridges and all that, but before you've even started doing fireworks shows and everything else. So there's all that in there. There's a particular frustration among Bath fans because they are the highest uptick for next season. So Bath have sent us some responses because of the emails that we've talked through there. And essentially they've said the reality is that they face significant cost increases across all areas of the club, not least the salary cap, which increases from £5 million to £6.4 million for next season. Also the rental and operation of our temporary stadium facilities at the Rec, operation investment in our training facilities and pitches and staff, including match day casual staff. I suppose the point in there is that they still rent the Rec. They have to pay the council to put the stands there and everything else.
Linking the salary cap to it
is interesting.
Is interesting.
Because the cap used to be that level before COVID.
It's basically saying if you want us to have Finn Russell and Ollie Lawrence and Ted Hill, then even though you've got fewer matches, you're going to have to pay for it.
But that's kind of going back to the West End point. If you want to go and see Sarah Jessica Parker, you're going to have to spend £150 for your ticket plus.
Yeah, and by the way, Harlequins don't struggle to sell out, and nor do Bath. So it's the same issue, that same conversation we have every year about Twickenham and the RFU and England. Why is it £190 to watch England play Ireland? Well, the reason is because that's the market. There's a lot of desire at the RFU to bring in, to take rugby to different communities, to new communities, to bring in new people to the sport. But the reality is that England games at Twickenham drive 85% of the RFU's revenue. So they're not going to sacrifice frankly, they're not going to sacrifice a section of tickets that they can sell for 190 quid to sell them to people for 60 quid. Yeah. They're just not going to do it. They'd love to take England around the country, go and play games in Newcastle and Manchester and Leeds, but they can't afford to do it, so they won't do it because they'll lose too much revenue. Bath and Harlequins are two good examples of very, very expensive match tickets, but they're still selling out.
Yeah, and Quins would argue that they're, and it's always one of those, because we get to this in shirt prices as well. We won't get onto the football thing with it, but that shirt's 120 odd quid, isn't it? And they will always say, when there's a new England rugby shirt, we think this represents value compared to others, which is what Quins was saying last week. Their season ticket, they think, sits quite fairly with what they offer with a big game and everything else. And Bath would say, if you buy a season ticket, you save yourself 25% if you were buying match or match tickets.
Where I have an issue, and there's no way of squaring the circle, but it's prohibitive for people who don't have season, like a season ticket holder at Bath knows what they're going to pay, and they might not want, like Ed Buckland who emailed us, this 24% increase is the tipping point. You know, he's done some sums and compared it, you know, index linked price from when they were in the Premiership semi-final. In fact, let me read it. The Premiership semi-final 2015 was £45. Its equivalent in 2024 is £99, which is a 120% increase. And accounting for inflation, it should be £59. So that is a huge jump. And for him and for others, it'll be too much. What I'm interested in is how accessible is it to take your kids to watch Harlequins or Bath if the individual prices for a one-off game are 70, 80, 90 quid. I think people would probably therefore target the big events, the big game at Christmas, the showdown at Tottenham, and maybe even that. You know, I had a mate who went to the showdown, loved it, and he said, oh, isn't it a shame that's the last chance I'll get to see Owen Farrell? And I was like, well, oh, first of all, I said, buy a ticket to the final and take your lads to the final, because they'll probably be there, and it's a really good day, and it's a great introduction day, and it's not astronomical in price. But in terms of keeping them engaged through the season, irregular visitors, I think there's a price issue there in allowing access to some of the more expensive clubs on an irregular basis if you want to take your kids along. And that reflects in some of the messages that we've had on email of how do you keep people engaged, how do you engage new people if what tickets there are for a one-off game cost a fortune.
The challenge too is the wider rugby / Premiership rugby challenge of what happens when, like, let's be frank, your current season ticket holders can't come anymore because they're too old, or they eventually die because they are very old. And who do you replace them with? How do you convince people who are now 15 to, when they start earning some money, buy a season ticket for Bath or for Quins or for Newcastle?
Did Quins give you a breakdown? Because I wonder whether there'll always be, I mean, maybe Harlequins are a separate case. There'll be their following will certainly be different to other clubs around the country. But will there always be 50-year-olds who follow Harlequins who have enough spare income to buy a season ticket?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there will be. But I remember a few years ago, and this may have been inflated for effect, but someone at one of the Premiership clubs saying that their average season ticket holder age was 65, which is absolutely incredible, really. And that's worrying for the Premiership, because what happens in 15 years? And like, I know that, like, if you talk to, so my, for example, my girlfriend's grandparents went to Bath for years. They've lived down in Bath for 30 years. And they stopped going after a while because it was like, well, firstly, Bath were getting a lot of Friday matches, which wasn't brilliant for them. They were in their 70s and above, and they thought, well, Saturday afternoon's great for us, go for lunch, go into town, whatever else. But Friday night, not so much. Bit of a harder thing to get to. And because Bath are one of the teams that could do Friday night games, they then obviously got more of them, whereas places like Saracens, they can't have it. Exeter can't have it because of the council. So there's stuff in there as well of what suits the fans, which is dictated by telly and all that too. And I would say that, again, that this would be a Quins point that they would want to make too, is that they do surveys of their own fans, which are not necessarily in-house surveys. They're these sort of wider things about experience at grounds and all that. And they come top of all the charts for everything, for fan experience and engagement and everything else. And that includes their offering of big game, and they get artists to come and play at half time and all that. They've just signed up Jess Glynn for the summer kickoff and all that. But yeah, it is an interesting thing, and we're not trying to single out Bath particularly. It was just that they emailed us a couple of fans. But yeah, interesting topic to debate, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks to those of you that did get in touch if anyone else wants to. theruck@thetimes.co.uk is the email address. But let's finish off the podcast with God or Goddess of the Week. Can I go first with the obvious tap-in answer here? Heard from her earlier in the podcast, but Marley Packer, 100 caps for England. Brilliant player, such a, so confrontational in that England back row. The captain of the team, and you'd imagine she would be keeping an eye on the future, really, with that home World Cup coming up as well, and England having a great chance on home soil to win some silverware. So Marley Packer is my goddess of the week. Will or Alex, either of you want to...
Before I do my god or goddess nomination, an honourable mention to Ben O'Keefe, the Kiwi referee, who was refereeing in the Super Rugby and trying to implement some of these new law tweaks we discovered last week about speeding up the play. And he was counting down the seconds for the use it call. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And actually Joe Marler tried it in the Sarries Quins game, and immediately Christoph Ridley was like, mate, no. We had a discussion before this with the coaches and we said we wouldn't do that. So can you stop, please? And Owen Farrell found it very funny. And actually after the game, he did a post-match interview explaining some of his decisions. And one of our colleagues from the other end of the world, Jamie Wall, was saying, he tweeted out and said, actually, you can speak to refs after the game, you just need to ask nicely.
Honestly,
so
it's
great.
It's what should happen. I mean, we went to the premiere of the Whistleblowers documentary, and it was a bit of a Q&A, and I asked Carl Dixon, I know you've spoken to referees.
Yeah, Luke Pearce, Matthew Rennell, yeah. they both would really like to do
yeah,
this.
Yeah, well, Luke was there at the screening, and I chatted to him about it, and then Carl Dixon went on the stage, asked him about it, and he's like it would help. Doesn't have to be in the kind of flash zone straight after the game. It could be on the Monday.
Or like a reactive. It's and not always looking for... I think the way that the authorities wouldn't like it to happen is if it was always reacting to a negative thing. Whereas if it was a sort of set-piece thing on a Monday or a Tuesday to review the stuff over the weekend, then it's constructive, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, they could do with it. They could do with it this week over the TMO yeah. howler, but... The reason the referees want it is because rugby is, despite the desire to make it black and white by using TMO more and more and TV replays more and more, it's a game of judgment. The referees are there to facilitate the game. Therefore, they'll make decisions in the facilitation of the game that some people might not agree with. But if you allow them to explain why they were doing it and what their thinking was, the referees think that will actually appeal to rugby
humanize
fans
them,
and humanize
a,
it.
I thought that at the time.
And make it
I
more of a
wrong.
Yeah, make it more of a discussion, a conversation. I think it should. I definitely think it should happen.
So that was my honourable mention.
Okay. So Ben O'Keefe's not the
no,
god of the week.
I'm going to go for Big Joe Thokonosiga, just because for years we've been fans of his, but frustrated that it's like, oh come on, he's got everything. Just I feel like someone needs to electrocute him before every game so he comes out absolutely fizzing. Because when he is, he's so good and he's got every genetic attribute you could possibly want, so gifted. You just think, god, if someone could get the best out of Joe Thokonosiga, then that is a great rugby player. So I was really pleased to see him play well and score a couple of tries. Should have had a hat trick and he dropped it.
Yes, which is almost Joe Thokonosiga in a nutshell.
Summed up, yeah.
Dropped the ball over the line. But he is, when he plays like that, you realise why England coaches can't ever quite discard him for good, because it's there, it's all there. Yeah, Finn Russell and Ben Spencer are bringing it out of him. So yeah, he was a man of the match actually on Sunday. I'll go for Owen Farrell on Saturday in that performance. You know, he's been through what he's been through. He's facing a career change. The way that he drove Saracens, and it's not to everyone's liking. You know, I think Hugh Tizard would probably have had his ear bent after the game, because he certainly had it in the game. But just the way that he led Saracens to come sprinting out of the blocks to set the standards makes it really difficult to see anyone other than them winning the title. Now, there are loads of other teams with credentials, but just the way they came charging out of the blocks and the leadership that he shows, I thought he was immense on Saturday. So he gets my God of the Week.
Three good nominations. Well, thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Ruck. Make sure you follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. Don't forget to email in as well. Will looks forward to reading all of your emails, especially when they aren't from IT. That's always an added bonus. But have a great week. We'll be back with you next Monday.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.